everyone, I'm Erin. I'm from the Women's Center. I'd like to welcome you to our Women on Wednesday series, Education, Advocacy, and Empowerment, celebrating 20 years. A few items before we get started, please turn off your cell phones or pagers, and please remain in your seats until 12:50 as a courtesy to our speaker. Also, if you could please fill out the evaluation sheet, we use this for future programming. The Women's Center would like to welcome Livia from the Office of Violence Against Women. She's here conducting the site visit on our Violence Against Women grant. Today's session is co-sponsored by the SESU American Indian Center, Multicultural Resource Center, and Women's Studies in honor of SESU American Indian Education Week and National Sexual Assault Awareness Month. There will be reception after today's session over at the American Indian Women's Center. The American Indian Center is over by the Education Building. And it's a great chance to have conversations with some of the people over at the center, and there is free food. So our session today is titled The Sexual Exploitation of American Indian Women and Girls. Our speaker will discuss Shattered Hearts, a research report that is believed to be the only of its kind, covering the commercial sexual exploitation of American Indian women and girls in Minnesota. The report chronicles the dangers and realities and impact of sex trafficking and sexual violence. Our speaker today is Suzanne Koeplinger. Susan is the executive director of the Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center. Susan is also a Canadian Mohawk and is of Canadian Mohawk and European ancestry, holds a master's degree in the art of leadership from Augsburg College, and is a certified substance abuse prevention specialist. She's had extensive civic, volunteer, and community experience, including service on the State of Minnesota Children's Justice Initiative Committee, the board of the American Indian Community Development Corporation. We are very grateful to have her here with us today. Please join the SESU American Indian Center, Multicultural Resource Center, Women's Studies, and the Women's Center in welcoming Suzanne Koeplinger.
Thank you, Erin, and thank you, Jane, and thank you all for coming. You have a handout in front of you, so I'm going to whip through some of these slides because you can look at the data all you want, but I just want to kind of set the context. And I'm a short person, and the podium is not my friend, so you won't see me behind that. I just, a little talking head appears behind the podium when I get behind it. The Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center is a nonprofit multi-service agency. We're 25 years old. We are located in South Minneapolis. We have four core programming areas. We have an early childhood learning center. We have supportive housing and emergency shelter. We have a library and training center. And then we have a core set of services called family stabilization. And family stabilization has a lot of child protection work, sexual violence, chemical dependency, and youth outreach. So within that context, we're doing a lot of work paying attention to some of the issues going on in our community. And a couple of years ago, we started paying attention to how well the clicker was working. Hello, there it is. Okay. Technology is not my friend either. We started paying attention to international sex trafficking. My background is partly in international development, and Minneapolis and St. Paul had been identified by the FBI as one of the 13 worst metropolitan areas in the country for sex trafficking. Surprised? Well, we are. One day, one of the residents of our supportive housing units came into my office, and this was a woman who had had a very rough road. She had drug addictions, she'd been in the criminal justice system, she had been homeless, she'd lost custody of her kids, and she was doing really good. She had worked hard to get free of drugs, she was working hard to get custody of her children back. While she was in our supportive housing program, her boyfriend broke in and stabbed her twice. So she was getting away from all that and rebuilding her life. So she walks into my office one day and she says, "I'm looking for a job, and nobody will give me a break. And the only way I know how to make money is to prostitute myself." And then she told me that when she was 12 years old, her mother sold her into prostitution to support a crack habit. By the time this young woman was 14, she had her own crack habit, and so she was pimping out other girls because she figured it was easier to get them to do some of the work than her to do all the work. She had gone to prison and done hard time. She had given birth to and lost custody of six children, and there she was at the age of 28 standing in my office saying, "Who's going to help me?" And I didn't have an answer for her, but I realized that this woman was a victim of a federal crime. The Trafficking Victims Protection Act is the federal law, and it says any commercial sexual exploitation of a juvenile, so anyone under the age of 18, is a victim of a federal crime. And yet we criminalize people for prostitution or prostitution-related activities. So I'm going to be talking a lot about prostitution and sex trafficking interchangeably, and I'll explain what's the same and what's the difference. The report that we conducted was really a limited report. We got a small grant from the Kellogg Foundation because we kept hearing more stories. We started asking tribal sexual assault advocates and other nonprofits and cops, what are you seeing around this issue? And we started hearing more and more stories. We had confirmed reports from Duluth police that Native girls were being taken off of northern reservations and brought to the port of Duluth and put on the ships to be raped by the freighter crews. So Duluth police told me this story. They can board a ship on a probable cause when it's at anchor. If it hoists anchor and goes, it's a Coast Guard problem or Homeland Security or somebody else, a federal agency has to deal with it. But the Duluth cops board this ship. They find two 15-year-old Native girls who have been raped repeatedly, beaten, stuffed into cubbyholes. The girls, who are traumatized and terrified, don't want to cooperate with the cops, and so they are arrested. No men are arrested. This is sex trafficking. This is a federal crime, and it needs to be dealt with as a federal crime. So, a little bit about the law. The federal law, there's two parts of the federal law that are important to understand. One is that for an adult, anyone over the age of 18, to be classified as a victim of sex trafficking, they must prove the use of force, fraud, or coercion into sexual exploitation. I have a problem with that because I think it re-victimizes the victim. The victim must prove that she was forced. She must prove that he said, I'll burn your little sister alive if you don't do what I tell you to do. She's got to prove that. And we think that's wrong. If you're a juvenile under the age of 18 and you are used in any form of commercial sexual exploitation, and by that I mean the exchange of sexual activity for something of value, exchanging sex for drugs, exchanging sex for shelter, for transportation, for power, anything of value, a commercial sexual exploitation act with a juvenile is a federal crime and a story. And yet, we use terms like juvenile hookers. Doesn't exist. They're victims of a federal crime. So we looked at what was going on in the state of Minnesota, and in 2005, the state of Minnesota had a sex trafficking statute on the books, and it was worthless. No one was using it to prosecute anything because it was essentially a slap on the wrist. So last year, we were at the legislature in partnership with a number of other organizations trying to get the Minnesota state statute amended so that it would remove the force, fraud, and coercion language and allow us to prosecute the crime of sex trafficking under state statute rather than federal statute. We were successful. Last year at the legislature, a unanimous vote of approval, and the governor signed it into law in May of 2009. The Minnesota state law essentially says no person can consent to be exploited. Any person used in commercial sexual transaction is a victim of sex trafficking under Minnesota state law. Now we're just waiting for the test case when somebody goes to jail for a really long time for this horrible crime. We set the context in our report. It's very important to understand that for Indian people in this country, there was a genocide attempted for many, many years. The context is important. People say, well, you know, you're blaming us for something we didn't do. No, no, no blame. The context is important. In this country, starting in the 1500s, there's well-documented evidence that people were using Native women as sex slaves. There was a loss of land, a loss of language, a loss of culture over many, many years. A couple of policies we really looked at. One was relocation policies. In the 1950s, particularly, a lot of Indian people were moved off of reservations into urban areas like Minneapolis, where they were promised jobs and housing. Didn't materialize, but in essence, it created urban ghettos, where there's high-density population of American Indians residing in poverty. There was and continues to be involuntary sterilization of Native women, where they get their tubes tied when they're under anesthesia without their permission or by coercion. But the most damaging policy that we look at is the boarding schools. In this country, and this only ended in the 1970s, by the way, Indian children as young as 5 were forcibly removed from their homes by sometimes well-meaning and sometimes not, government or church officials. who took those children far away and put them into a boarding school where they were forbidden to speak their language. They were forbidden to honor their customs or their traditions. They were often sexually abused, often physically abused, and on a daily basis, they were told they were bad, they were dirty, and if they ever wanted to amount to anything in this world, they shouldn't be Indians. When school was over, the lucky ones went home. And I say the lucky ones because we are now discovering mass graves at the site of boarding schools all over Canada and North America and the United States as well. Those who went home could not communicate with their parents or their grandparents because they no longer spoke the language. They also had a lot of anxiety and confusion about who they were. Well, we just got told for 10 years that my family was dirt. But yet, I love these people. So a lot of confusion, a lot of depression, a lot of anxiety. A lot of them start self-medicating using alcohol and drugs. They have babies. They don't know how to parent these children because they were not parented. They did not have the benefit of growing up with their parents. And that's a multi-generational cycle that is continuing today. So it's very important to just understand that context when we talk about some of the disparities in Indian country. We start out by looking at a basic fundamental concept of how people develop into a healthy, normal, well-adjusted individual in this world. The world is a good and rewarding place. The world is predictable, meaningful, and fair. I am a worthy person, and people are trustworthy. Now, if you grow up with these four fundamental beliefs, you have a good chance at doing okay. Not everybody gets this, and some get it to some degree or another. But if you have already been marginalized and discriminated against by a system that deems you less than, if you have already grown up in extreme poverty with dysfunctional family systems, if you already don't trust law enforcement or government officials, you have a disadvantage right out of the gate. For the research, we did a couple of things because there was no data. No one had looked at this. So we think this is the first research of its kind in the country, and we're hearing more and more that's true. We looked at Canadian research because the Canadians are way ahead of us in terms of analyzing scope of sexual victimization and Aboriginal populations. And when I say Aboriginal or First Nations, it's just a Canadian way of talking about American Indians or Indigenous people. And there are very strong similarities between places like Winnipeg and Minneapolis, Vancouver and Seattle, in terms of population of Aboriginal Indigenous people and sexual victimization. So we looked at some of their data. We had some intake data at my agency, and you're going to see some of these numbers, where three programs that see high rates of sexual violence, we did an intake to screen in who meets the definition of being a sex trafficking victim. We looked at ancillary data from Wilder Research, the Minnesota Student Survey, and then we held two roundtable discussions with frontline advocates, one in Duluth, one in Minneapolis. Many of the advocates were themselves survivors of sex trafficking. So, commercial sexual exploitation I talked about. Prostitution. Prostitution is often talked about as a lifestyle choice or as a victimless crime, and it is neither. And I hope that if you get nothing else out of this talk today, you leave here really questioning how we as a society have deemed it okay to rape women and children and call it prostitution and make it a lifestyle choice. The average age of entry into prostitution in this country is between 12 and 14. What 12-year-old wakes up in the morning and says, this is my dream job? I want to be raped and brutalized by strangers every day. 12 to 14 is the average age of entry into prostitution. Remember that. So when you become 19, you suddenly made a lifestyle choice and now you're a criminal? We believe that because of the federal law and the state law, the vast majority of women who have been prostituted, and I intentionally use the verb, we don't need to title them with what has been done to them. We don't call battered women batteries. So why do we call prostituted women prostitutes? They have been prostituted. The vast majority of them were first pimped out as children, therefore making them victims of a federal crime, therefore making them victims of sex trafficking, not juvenile hookers. Sex trade, sex trafficking, victim, we talk a lot about this in our report. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, but how we talk about these things is very important. For example, drives me crazy that we talk about the men who solicit, who are the cause of this, by the way. Men who solicit are the demand. This is a market-driven enterprise. If there were no demand, there would be no supply. If there weren't men willing to pay to degrade and violate women and children, sometimes boys and men, but largely women and children, female children, then there would be no supply. So why aren't we talking about these guys? John's patrons, customers, that's what we call them, right? Very nice language, very nice. John is a book in the Bible. John is a friend of mine. Patrons, customers, you know, a business has patrons and customers. If you read the newspaper about a sex trafficking bust, they'll say these girls were forced to service 20 to 30 men a night. Service! I don't know, service in my mind is, can I get you some more coffee? How's that steak? That's service. This is rape. We're talking about rape. And the men who solicit are criminals because they are also breaking the law. And if they're soliciting prepubescent children, they are sex offenders. So let's start calling it what it is. The women are called sluts, whores, crack whores, dirty hookers, tramps. And I'm saying they're victims of sex crimes. So the damage of a life in prostitution. I already mentioned the average age of entry into prostitution is between 12 and 14. Our data shows women as young as the age of 8 years old, being sold into prostitution. We know that women who have been prostituted have physical and sexual violence rates extraordinarily high. 70 to 90% of them report rape, sexual assaults. Extremely high rates of chemical addiction. So some people will say, well, is she addicted to drugs because she's been prostituted, or has she been prostituted because she's addicted to drugs? And I say, what difference does it make? Sometimes the grooming and the pimping techniques involve giving the girls free drugs so that they become addicted, so that they're much more compliant and easy to control. But there's high rates of chemical addictions, high rates of PTSDs. Some studies tell us that women who have been prostituted have higher post-traumatic stress syndrome rates than Iraqi war veterans. And they're murdered 40 times the general population. And do you ever read about that? Because they're disposable women. The things that aren't listed here are things like what we see and what we hear about, and I know there's some of you who are studying medicine in this room, extremely high rates of traumatic brain injuries because they're getting their heads slammed against dashboards, they're getting their heads slammed against a brick wall, they're getting pistol whipped upside the head, hearing loss, broken teeth, a lot of dental injuries from getting punched in the face, getting pistol whipped, getting hit with baseball bats in the head. That's a lifestyle choice, isn't it? Huge amounts of reproductive health damage. Forced abortions. Think about this. Forced to have sex with 20 to 30 men a day at the age of 12. Think about what that does to a child's reproductive system, as well as their mental well-being. So we also took a look at the resilience in the American Indian community, because this is not our tradition. There is no word for rape in the Dakota language, or in the Ojibwe language. There's no word for rape. Was not part of the traditional structures. If a man violated a woman or a child in a traditional native culture, he was ostracized from the community. Sometimes he was killed. It just was not accepted. So, a couple of things from the roundtable discussions we saw. I got to move a little bit more quickly, don't I? The prevalence and the normalization were the most disturbing things that we saw. I heard a 13-year-old girl once at my agency say, yeah, my cousin got gang raped, but, you know, it just happens. Gang rape just happens? Sexual violence in American Indian communities is off the charts. Amnesty International did a study 2 years ago. It's called Maze of Injustice. You can Google Amnesty USA and download it. They call sexual violence against American Indians in this country a human rights violation. The United States is a signatory to the Declaration of Human Rights, and yet we are in violation of human rights in this country when it comes to sexual violence against Native women. They say that Native women are raped 1 out of 3. 1 out of 3 Native women will be raped in her lifetime. And you talk to my staff and they say, where are the other two? Who are they? They're just not telling the truth. That's how prevalent it is. The Department of Justice tells us that 70% of sexual violence assaults against Native women are not reported. So we know it's 3 times as bad, but we don't even know about 70%. So it's bad. The prevalence and the normalization. There are some girls who just think it's inevitable. I'll either get beat up or raped at some point in my life, and probably more than once. Okay, this is the intake numbers from our programming, 3 programs that had high rates of sexual violence. It's a small number for you researchers out there, 95 women screened in over a period of 6 months. But the indicators are very alarming. Exchanging sex for shelter, food, money, drugs, it's a common occurrence. Some quotes from the roundtable discussions, again reiterating the young age. 19 was old for women who've been prostituted, with some of the advocates who are working in the streets of Duluth or Minneapolis. 14, 15, 12 years old, very common. Age when first prostituted, this is our intake again, one-third prostituted between the ages of 8 and 12. Sex trafficking victims, victims of a federal crime. By the way, trafficking does not need to involve transportation. There's a misconception about what trafficking is. You don't have to be transported anywhere in order to be a victim of trafficking. The federal law says forced fraud or coercion for an adult or any commercial sexual transaction for a child. So it doesn't need to involve transportation, and it doesn't necessarily mean foreign nationals. There are internationally trafficked victims, labor trafficking, sex trafficking, mail order brides, bondage. But there are domestically trafficked victims as well. And that's the population that has not been getting any attention. And what we're trying to say is it all needs our attention because none of it is okay. There's no hierarchy of abuse. You know, you can't say, well, a woman who's trafficked from the former Soviet Union who comes here and has her passport taken away from her, she's got a huge set of traumas. She's probably got much deep-seated fear from law enforcement. She comes from a culture where cops are not your friend. She doesn't know this country at all. So she needs a specific set of services. But an American Indian or an African American or a Caucasian girl who's been trafficked, she also needs help. So there's no hierarchy of it's much worse for one group than for others. Patterns of entry. Now, stripping and pornography are legal for adults. We also know that stripping and pornography are used as gateways into prostitution for children. We know that girls as young as 12 and 14 are given fake IDs and they're stripping. We also know, we heard a lot about this, for those of you who are from the northern part of the state, I'm sorry, I'm not casting aspersions, but during hunting season, all the little bars, not all, many of the little bars in hunting territory become strip clubs. We know that there are men who are hired out of Duluth and out of Bemidji to drive the girls from one bar to the next, where they are told, if you don't go upstairs with these guys, you don't get a ride out of here. And so they go and they're raped by 10 men that night, and that's their entry into prostitution. So stripping and pornography are legal for adults. They're also forms of degradation and forms of violence. And I want you to think about it. Internet sexting, you know, we hear a lot about this. It's very alarming. It's part of that normalization. The emotional connection. So these last two bullet points. Wait, Casey, ready? Casey said nobody ever uses the laser point. There it is, Casey, laser point. Yay! The emotional connection between the pimps and the boyfriends and guerrilla pimping and finesse pimping. That's probably the last you'll see of the laser pointer. Two things. Finesse pimping, and this is, by the way, the Mall of America is a prime recruitment site. We know this. Groups of girls go into the Mall of America, and these guys, they know how to pick out the one who's feeling a little rebellious, that girl who's got some self-esteem issues. They know how to approach them. They're smart. They're very smart. And the come on usually goes something like this. You know, it's, hey, baby, you know, nobody loves you the way I love you. It's all that sweet talk. I'm going to buy you stuff. She believes he's the one. Now, consider the fact that she's probably coming from some dysfunction if she's vulnerable. We'll talk about vulnerabilities. But he starts coming on like he loves her, and she believes it. Similar dynamic to what we see with domestic violence. She begins to buy into it, and he begins to control and tighten the control. And at one point, and sometimes he's buying her nice stuff, so here's something you want to watch out for. If one of your friends, who you know does not have money, starts showing up with really nice stuff, you might want to wonder, where is she getting that stuff? Maybe a nice boy's buying it for her. Maybe he's a good guy and he really means well, but maybe not. So buying her stuff, treating her nice, and then all of a sudden it's like, you know, I need you to do something for me. We need some drugs. He's giving her drugs. Maybe he's getting her into a lifestyle that she's not accustomed to, but he kind of coerces her into it. And then he starts saying things like, you need to go sleep with my friends to pay off this debt. And she says, well, I can do it for him this one time because he really loves me and he wouldn't ask me if it didn't mean a lot to him, and they're not too bad. And minimization and rationalization. So when you have a finesse pimping activity, it's about an emotional relationship that is created with the pimp. Guerrilla pimping is just violence. It's just flat out violence. And here's the story. This is a true story. We have a program at the Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center called the Phoenix Project, and it's an outreach to young girls who are at high risk of being exploited, 13 to 17 years old. So we had a 12-year-old or a 13-year-old and a 14-year-old girl in our program, and they were coming in for case management services, and they're sitting on a bench outside my agency one day, and all of a sudden our receptionist starts yelling, they're fighting, they're fighting. So I go out there, And there's two older girls. When I say older, I mean 16 and 17. One of whom is about 6 months pregnant. And they're just pounding on these two little girls. They're yanking clumps of hair and they're biting. So I get in the middle of it. It's like, whoa, stop this fighting. It's a hockey brawl. And come to find out, what's happened is these two younger girls are coming into us because they're homeless. They're trying to keep going to school, but mom is addicted, and mom just got evicted from her apartment again, so they have no place to go. And these older girls have been pimped out by the gangs, and they have their instructions from the gangs. You bring us fresh meat, or you're going to get your ass kicked again tonight. And so in order to not get beat up again, they're trying to beat up these younger girls and bring them in, so that raises their status with the gang. Now, you can be raped in, or you can be beat in to the gang. In particularly the Native mob. I'm not talking about all gangs generically, but what we heard. So if you get raped in, you just get raped by every single guy in the gang. And they make sure everybody's in town before they hold this initiation. They'll get on the cell phone and say, it's all happening over here. Be there. And they all take their turns until they're done. And then she's a member of the gang. You can get beat in. Then you take a rough beating for, I think it depends, 6 or 7 minutes per person. Then you don't have to get raped in, but then you have to promise to bring in some younger girls so that they can get raped in. This is normalization of sexual violence in a gang culture. So it's very important. The FBI calls it finesse pimping. They call it grooming. And there are very, very sophisticated tactics that are being used that appeal to the vulnerabilities. So who's doing the pimping? Friends. Largely friends. We saw a lot of this. Oh, yeah, my friend took me to a party. Somebody slipped me a date rape drug. I got gang raped. They videotaped it. And then they said, now, bitch, you're going to do what I tell you to do, or I'll show this to your grandma. And she's ashamed and terrified, and so she does what she's told to do. And that's the beginning for her. Family members, this is very alarming. But we also know that multi-generational cycle of abuse and trauma, there's no explanation for a mother to pimp out her child than it was normalized for her. We know of women who have been pimped out by their fathers, sold into pornography at the age of 5 by their fathers, used to pay off drug debts by their stepfathers, their brothers, their mothers, their cousins, their grandfathers. Landlords, Casey, look at this. Yeah, landlords. This is a really interesting one. We heard a lot of stories. This is a number, a small number, but we think this is a sort of undiscovered trend, particularly for vulnerable young Native moms, 22, 23-year-old, or in their late 20s with prepubescent girls, where they fall behind on their rent. And the landlord says, you know, you're behind on your rent, but I think I know how we can work this out. I kind of like that daughter of yours. Or I'm going to put you on Craigslist and sell you. And that happens. So the vulnerability and risk factors. So our study focused on American Indians. But if you look at these vulnerability and risk factors, you look at any community, these are similar to what's in international sex trafficking. The social framework that we see making vulnerability factors extremely high for the girls and sometimes boys who are being sold into prostitution, it's very similar in some of our Indian communities. Extremely high rates of violence in the home. Runaways and throwaways. When I talk about throwaways, I'm talking about kids aging out of the foster care system or kids who have come out as GLBT and their families just said, get out. We don't want you here anymore. The average age of entry into prostitution in this country is between what? 12 and 14. Average age of runaways in this country is between 12 and 14, interestingly enough. So if you're a runaway and you're a 13-year-old girl and maybe you have some trauma in your life, maybe you were already molested by your mom's boyfriend or a cousin or somebody at a party at your house, and you're running away from something, right? You have an average of 36 to 48 hours on the streets of any metro area before you are approached by a pimp or a john and offered an exchange of sex for shelter. Sex for transportation, sex for drugs. And you might think, I'm doing what I got to do. I'm taking care of business. I'm in control. But what you don't realize is that, as a child, you have just become a victim of a federal crime. And the man who just offered you a place to sleep in exchange for raping you is now a sex offender. We don't talk about that, though, do we? Substance abuse. We saw very high correlations between addictions, chemical dependency, and vulnerability of children. So if mom and dad are just whacked out all the time on something, they're not much paying attention to what's going on with their kids. And there's probably other people around who are very willing to take advantage of that situation. FASD, fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. Brain damage of children in the womb when mom drinks. You don't have to binge drink. You don't have to be a drunk. You just have to know that if you consume alcohol while you're pregnant, you are risking brain damage of your child. If you do binge drink, the risks go up. So FASD means the brain is malformed, and it has a whole spectrum. So it's called spectrum disorders because it can appear in a number of different ways. You can look at a child who's FASD impacted and go, oh yeah, physical deformities, this child's got some issues. You can look at another child and see nothing wrong with that child, and yet the behaviors will tell us that there's a problem. And the behaviors are often lack of good judgment, poor understanding of cause and effect, and a deep need to please people. So go down that road and find yourself on the streets of Minneapolis or St. Cloud, being a runaway, having brain damage, wanting to please people, not really understanding the consequences of your actions, and you can see what happens next. Poverty is an extreme indicator, dropping out of school, and child protection interventions. We didn't get real deeply into the system with child protection, but we know that in Hennepin County, for example, the budget cuts have made layoffs in the child protection staff. So if you have a 14-year-old girl who's being sexually molested within her family and she runs away and the cops pick her up, even if it's reported as a child abuse situation, there's no staff to handle teenage sexual abuse. So the budget cuts are having a real impact on how the child protection staff can intervene in sexual abuse of children. More quotes on the normalization. I can let you read these. I don't need to read them to you. A little bit more data. One of the things we looked at, the Minnesota Student Survey, this is statewide, and it's self-reporting by 6th, 9th, and 12th grade girls. We pulled out four counties that have high populations of Native kids: Beltrami County, St. Louis County, Ramsey, and Hennepin. And we looked at the data for Native girls and American Indian in combination, stacked up against all girls. And a lot of that data is in our report, which you can access, you can access on our website. I'll tell you more about that. But you can see these disparities, and you're going to see a couple more of them. Homelessness is a huge indicator. If you have a homeless woman and child on the streets, they're extremely vulnerable. A lot of women stay in violent relationships. They stay in domestic violence situations because they have no place to go. But that also means that they're more likely to be sexually abused, and their children are more likely to be abused, either sexually or physically. I think these numbers speak for themselves. The number of women who have been homeless and who have been sexually abused or physically assaulted, very high. More data on physically abusive relationships and staying in abusive relationships because you have nowhere else to go. So here in this state, we have 140 shelter beds for unaccompanied youth. In the state, 140. On any given night, Wilder research tells us that there's between 1,500 and 2,000 unaccompanied youth on the streets of Minnesota, and we think that's underreported because a lot of kids just aren't being counted. And about a quarter of them are Indian kids. So where are they going to go? We can help them a lot until 4:30 in the afternoon at my organization, and then out they go. Knowing someone who is in prostitution increases the risk. I'm just going to go through some of these kind of quickly because I'm running out of time. Alcohol use in the home, again, very high correlation between alcohol abuse and use in the home and vulnerability to children. This kills me. The number of Indian kids who are reportedly started using alcohol before they were 12 years old. We're seeing girls coming into our programs who've already been raped by the age of 11 multiple times, and they're using alcohol to dull the pain. We know there's a strong correlation between sexual trauma that is not addressed or dealt with and heightened rates of chemical abuse and depression anxiety disorders. Clear links. So if we know girls aren't reporting their abuse, they're very likely to develop self-destructive behaviors. Dropping out of school. If you don't have a work history, and you don't have an education, and you don't have an address, who's going to hire you? So how are you going to make money? So you may think it's kind of cool when you're young to do this sort of thing because you can take care of it, but when you get to be the age of the woman who walked into my office, 28, had no work experience, no GED, didn't know how she was going to make a dime other than flat on her back. That's the life. So we have a better chance of interrupting with younger girls than we do with the older women, but we don't give up on them. So they're barriers to exit. We saw a lot of distrust of the system. Law enforcement, there are good cops and there are bad cops, just like in any profession. there are good and bad everywhere, and we know that there are some cops who take advantage of women who've been prostituted, and we know that there are some cops who go out of their way to try and help them get out of that life. But what happens is, the word on the street is, don't trust cops. Don't trust them, because there's some bad ones out there. So those women don't report. Distrust of advocates. So the American Indian community, thank you. American Indian community is a small community. And sometimes a woman's going to come into my agency and she's not going to want to talk to the advocate because she's thinking, you know my family. I'm not telling you my stuff. So mistrust of what this word is going to get out around the community. Absence of real options. Funder restrictions. This is a much deeper conversation than I have time to go into right now, but there are no federal dollars being allocated to serve domestically trafficked victims in this country. There are dollars being allocated to serve internationally trafficked victims, and we think they should get more. But there are no dollars being devoted to American citizens who are trafficked into sexual slavery. Zero. Finally, the don't talk rule. Fear and shame are huge controllers, and people don't want to talk about this. This is a crime that thrives in secrecy. If these guys, if you know what they're up to, you know, you might want to do something about it. So they love it when people are quiet. So go back to the gang thing. If you're a gangbanger and you're dealing drugs, you got some heroin or some cocaine or whatever you're dealing, and you get busted, well, there it is. There's the evidence. It's there's no denying it. And you can only sell that once. But if you're dealing in human flesh, you got a 14-year-old girl who's been prepped for the market, and I mean raped and beaten, you can sell her as many times as you want. And she's going to lie her butt off for you because she's terrified that you're going to go and kill her family or burn her mother alive, or she's going to get whipped with a coat hanger that night, or she's going to be sodomized by a wooden stick that's been on fire. These things happen. So it's something that goes on every day in our community that nobody wants to talk about. We're talking about it. We want to reframe this issue to stop criminalizing the victims and start holding the perpetrators accountable. We want to provide the services that the victims need. We need to provide more training across all systems, medical professionals, teachers, cops, judicial systems, social service providers, parents. Everybody needs to understand this. We need to start prosecuting these guys and putting them in jail. So let me tell you a quick story about what Sweden did. Sweden, the Swedish model, and I don't mean the Swedish model. I mean, the Swedish model. In Sweden in 1999, they passed legislation that did two things. They legalized prostituting oneself, and then they criminalized and enhanced the penalties for the solicitation thereof. So I can go out there and sell it, and it's not a problem, but if you want to buy it, boy, you are in trouble. And then they realized that if 95% of the women who have been prostituted want to get out, but they don't have the resources, we need to invest. So they pumped money into housing, job training, chemical health, mental health, all the things that those women needed to rebuild their lives and become healthy, tax-paying citizens. And then they trained the system, the cops and the bench. You arrest these guys and you put them in jail. This is the law now. And today, in Stockholm, most of the brothels are gone. Most of the massage parlors are gone. Neighboring Finland estimates that they have an international sex trafficking population of between 15 and 17,000 individuals a year. Sweden estimates that theirs is between 2 and 400. Because they interrupted the market on the demand side. Can we do that in Minnesota? I'm just asking. I think that it's a long-term cost savings. People start saying, well, there's no money. We can't afford that. Look at what we do now. We arrest women, not men. Very rarely are the men arrested. We arrest the women. They get booked. They go to the workhouse. They do their time in the prison. Then they get released. There's no services for them. There's no housing for them. So where do they go? Back to the pimp. And then they're out on the streets again. They go into detox or they go into the emergency room. All taxpayer dollars. You're paying for all of it. And eventually they're going to get arrested again. And then they're going to go back to the system. And it's not working. It's not helping anybody. So we have to change the way we're looking at the problem and start creating some solutions that are effective. In the Indian community, we also had a meeting with community leadership, and they gave us some very clear direction about how we needed to proceed in a culturally congruent way, and we're honoring those suggestions. This is not just a woman's issue. There's the laser light, Casey. I'm so glad to see all you guys here because this is your issue too. We need you to stand up on this. It can't just be a woman's issue. You need to have the courage to say this is not okay, that prostitution is not a lifestyle choice, that it is not a victimless crime. And when you hear your buddies making jokes about it, ha ha ha, know that what you're joking about is violence. And you're perpetuating a system of violence that abuses women and children. Got little sisters? Got older sisters? Would this be okay for your mom to do? Would this be okay for your sister to do? Or your girlfriend? So we need you. So thank you for being here. Since the release of the report, we've had some great response. Senator Al Franken, who is on the Indian Affairs Committee, interjected an amendment to the Indian Crime Reform Act that requires the federal government to research and intervene into the sex trafficking of American Indians in this country. And we were told that was based on our report. So that's really good news. AFNAP is called A Future, Not a Past. It's a model program in Atlanta, Georgia, that has identified child sex trafficking as a horrendous crime, which it is, and has taken steps to put a stop to it. So they've created a safe shelter for children who've been trafficked victims, and then they've broadly trained all the systems so anybody who comes into contact with an at-risk kid knows how to work with that child, how to get them into safety, and how to begin to build a case against the perpetrators. I'm going to Denver next week to have a discussion with a lot of people who have lots and lots of money who are looking at Minnesota as the next pilot state to create that model. And we think that's very good news. Finally, my organization just got a $400,000 grant from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation. I'm going to be hiring additional staff in the coming months to expand our youth outreach program and to add one trafficking coordinator position that will work with Duluth, work with the tribes, work with St. Cloud, work with everybody to begin to bring community forums, to bring listening sessions, to offer trainings to people who want more trainings, to do more presentations so that we can raise awareness across domains. And we're very excited about having that opportunity. So I don't want to run over too much time. I can continue to talk, you know. I can do that. But I'd like to answer questions and just have more of a dialogue if that's something that you're interested in doing. So tell me what questions you have, or what did I say that you just think is wacky, or what do you want more information about, or comments about, anything. Yes. Great question. The question was, how does my organization work to prevent re-victimization of American Indian victims by systems, child protection, etc.? We are working to try and raise the awareness within the systems. We have improved relationships with Minneapolis police, but we've got a long way to go. So we brought our research. By the way, the research, those of you who are sneaking out, if you want to get the report, it's online. It's on our website. There's a full copy and a summary copy. I'm going to bring them over to the Indian Center after this and leave them there. But you can go onto our website and access these reports. But one of the things that we need to do is begin to hold more cross-systems trainings with child protection, law enforcement, and the judicial system. Because there's still a gross generalization that child prostitution exists. And I'm saying, no, it does not. Child rape exists, but it's not prostitution. So the child protection system, the pushback that we get there is there's not enough money in the system to open up a case to investigate. We have one family that was referred to a voluntary program at our agency where we know that the mother was prostituting the children. The 13-year-old girl was pregnant, and the 11-year-old girl was hooked on drugs. And they wouldn't remove those children because they're not in the right age group because they're short-staffed at the county. So we really need people to understand the impact of budget cuts on these children. But what we offer is a safe place. No one comes into our agency and says, I was prostituted or I was sex trafficked. They come in because they need housing. They come in because they were raped. They come in because they're in the child protection system. And so that gives us the opportunity to begin to meet their needs in a very non-judgmental, holistic way. But we have a long way to go to try and prevent the re-victimization that happens when children are removed from their home by child protection. Sometimes they're reunited when they shouldn't be because the system doesn't always recognize what sex trafficking looks like. So, yeah, good question. Yes? Question is, how did I get so involved and passionate about this problem? I'm a survivor of rape. I'm a survivor of domestic violence, and I know how hard it was for me to move on through that journey. I cannot imagine. I mean, I just can't imagine what it's like to have that much trauma in a young person's life, repeated trauma. And the other thing is, I'm just pissed off. You know, why are why do we sort of deem that these are throwaway people? Why we, you know, we live in a society that values human life. These lives have value too. Why aren't we valuing these lives? Why aren't we taking care of our children? Why do we have our priorities so askewed that we can't recognize that when the tide rises, all the boats float, and these are children who are going to grow up to have children of their own, and if we don't intervene now, we're going to have a much bigger problem. And the injustice of it all just ticks me off. So my own experiences, the work that I do at the agency, seeing some of the young girls come in, I go down to my child care center, I look at those babies, and I go, if we don't do something, these babies are at risk. And I won't even tell you some of the really bad stuff that we've heard from some of the situations that we worked in, but it's very hard. It's very hard to know that this is going on and nobody really seems to care. So that's why. Yes? The question was about the relationship between the growth of gangs on reservations and this problem. We know there's a huge amount of gang involvement in sex trafficking. We know that Native Mob, particularly, which is the largest Native gang in the upper Midwest, is very involved in both drug trafficking and sex trafficking. We just saw the state eliminate the Gang Strike Task Force for bad behavior. Well, what's coming in to replace that? So we really need to see some sort of regional intervention that identifies gang members and deals with that appropriately. You know, the budget cuts, again, budget cuts are hurting the work that we're trying to do, because we need youth programs, we need adequate housing, we need all of those things, but we need to let cops do their jobs. And we need to have the BIA, which is the Bureau of Indian Affairs. The FBI has jurisdiction on some reservations in Minnesota. It's a very complex jurisdictional issue, but we really need to bring cross-systems training to the entities that are responsible for law enforcement on reservations. Now, there is an initiative that we're supporting. It's called iCare, and it's a data sharing system for tribal law enforcement that will also share information with urban city police and FBI, which does not exist right now. We don't have any data system that gathers crime rates in Indian country. When I say Indian country, I just mean anywhere there's high populations of Indians, either reservation or urban. So identifying the gangs is part of the problem. We hear a lot about gangs and drug trafficking, but we have yet to start hearing a huge outcry about gangs and sex trafficking. Yes? Yeah, the question was about the jurisdiction and about the prevalence of rape and violence on reservations, because people know they can get away with it, and yes. PL-280 jurisdictions, I'll get to you in a second, PL-280 jurisdictions mean that on some reservations in the state of Minnesota, FBI has authority over what's called Part 1 crimes, which are the serious crimes, including rape, and local tribal officials on other reservations have authority, but they've been hamstrung by the federal government. So if you have, it depends on who the victim is, who the perpetrator is, and where the assault takes place. So, hypothetical, if you have a white male who rapes a Native woman on the Leech Lake Reservation, and she reports, and he's prosecuted by tribal officials, he can't get more than 1 year in prison, even if he's a level 3 sex offender or a child molester, because the federal government will not allow those tribal courts to prosecute non-Natives to the extent of the law. So that's a problem. Last question. Yes. Question is, can women who are on reservations come to us? Yes. Anyone can come to us. They don't have to be an enrolled tribal member. We don't ask for tribal affiliation. We serve a lot of mixed-race people. Anyone who identifies as American Indian or who believes a culturally based, strength-based healing service menu will meet their needs are welcome to come to us. Check out our website. I'm going to go over and have lunch over at the Indian Center. Is there any last question, burning question that you got to get answered before I get away from you? I really appreciate your time. I appreciate your compassion and your concern. Thank you very much.